This week, the precious metals blasted to the highest point in months, while the Dow Jones Industrials recorded its best close yet again in its 118-year history, broken records all around. Welcome, everyone. Great to be back with you. We have yet another big Goldseek radio episode. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you for another Muy Grande size show. Well, we have a couple of must-hear interviews this week, starting with Andrew Maguire. You've probably heard that he blew the whistle in London on gold and silver market manipulation. He makes his debut appearance here on the show. Each ounce of metal on the exchanges is leveraged 100-to-1. Oh, just 100-to-1. It required only 10-to-1 leverage to lead to the great crash of 1929. What's going to happen when this thing comes down? Well, Katie barred the doors on gold and silver. He also talks about the six key bullion banks, and he says they know all of the major turning points in the market, but expect that manipulation to end this year. Then our old friend Bob Hoy, senior investment strategist at Institutional Advisors, takes some time away from the digital screens. We discuss the similarities once again between the 1920s and the Fed's operations today, holding rates too low, and what happened in 1929. Well, we all know that story, right? Bob says the only thing holding back hyperinflation is the bond stock market rally, and eventually that's headed for the metals. And of course, we open up the phone line and the mailbag for listeners' questions and comments. You know, I received a message today that said I sounded depressed. You know, if this is depressed, heaven help us if mania ever erupts. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his must-hear report. Goldseek.com radio begins now with the market recapitulation. Sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week on continued U.S. dollar market weakness. Investors sold the greenback in favor, once again, of gold and silver on weaker than expected consumer sentiment numbers and inflation figures. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was up about $40, over 3% for the week, shooting up over that 1200 mark, ending at 1225 an ounce. Silver picked up $1.14, closing at $17.58 an ounce, also its best showing in months. And the XAU also picked up nearly 3%, ending at 75, while West Texas Intermediate crude picked up a fractional amount, ending just shy of $60 a barrel. The top story driving the precious metals higher this week was the sluggish U.S. dollar. Gold blasted to a three-month high at least on Friday, probably its best rally of the year, on weak U.S. consumer sentiment data, which sent the U.S. dollar lower. And, of course, lower-than-expected producer price data helped the metals. The core rate sans food and energy fell about 0.2%, double analyst estimates. Although lower inflation figures would seem to offer the Fed wiggle room to raise rates, at least on the surface, investors interpreted the number as a sign of lowered economic domestic strength, making low interest rates the ideal panacea, and perhaps putting off the Fed's upcoming rate hike for a while. The news put a huge smile on the largest gold ETF holder in the world. Billionaire investor John Paulson continues to maintain his mega-size position for a seventh straight quarter, according to an SEC report this week. The Uber investor at Paulson & Company is currently the largest holder of the Spider Gold Trust, with over 10 million shares under management. The ETF is held to back gold funds for interested clients. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, this week caught, I think, the shorts off guard. Couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch of folks. Still, one big week does not a bull market make. As pleasing as it is to look in the charts, we still have those pesky head and shoulders patterns in effect. So be sure and log into the Alpha Stocks newsletter account. I've got a special report up there for all of my readers. And moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week. For the second week running, the Dow Jones Industrials ended at the highest level in its 118-year history. As mentioned earlier, 18,191, up 167 points, about 1%. 10%. The S&P 500 also closed at a record high, 2,067, about 8 points and less than 0.5%. And the NASDAQ closed at 50.48, up 44 points for the week, about 1%. A top story on Wall Street this week involved Netflix shares, NFLX is the ticker symbol, which exploded over 26% on talks with broadcasting companies with distribution channels in China, opening up that massive consumer market about three times or more than the U.S. is viewed as a huge plus for one of my favorite companies other than Amazon.com. Another hot stock and regular Alpha Stocks newsletter candidate, Domino's Pizza, DPZ, which is poised to continue its remarkable advance. In related news, although the retail sales numbers were somewhat sluggish this week, and consumer spending and sentiment not too robust, still, unemployment is officially at the levels that the Fed likes to see, so it's still approaching that perfect world environment, even though our price-to-earnings ratios on the general S&P 500 is well above last year and a bit over its typical range. Investors just haven't lost their passion for stocks. Bottom line on Wall Street, our 7 indicator index remains in the neutral zone, and all three major indices are still in rally mode. I like the prospects for higher prices, but be sure and log in for all of our favorite candidates for next week's market. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with must-hear interviews with Andrew McGuire and Bob Hoy. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Andrew McGuire, an independent London metals trader for at least four decades, decided to tell the public what many folks have been concerned about for quite some time, especially over at GATA, our friends there, Chris Powell, and of course, Bill Murphy. It's a pleasure to welcome Andrew McGuire to the show in his debut appearance. Hello, sir.
Well, nice to be with you, Chris.
What an interesting story. And apparently J.P. Morgan, HSBC, a few others may be manipulating the precious metals markets. By now, most people know there's something amiss, but you have delved down into the minutia. Tell us more, please.
I think, if we sort of wind back to, if you recall, back in 2008, and I think what really brought me into this was the real world aspect to what was going on. When we saw Bear Stearns go down and we saw J.P. Morgan take over Bear Stearns, for example, and we saw the silver price drop from 21 down to 8.5. You remember that in a matter of months. It's one thing to be looking at a chart and it's one thing to be looking at a dot on a screen, but what really, really got me interested in exposing this, what would be, to be honest, a very lucrative trade, was the fact that real world people were suffering. And, you know, when we see mines being shuttered and people being put out of work, just general hardship, and this is all part of the problems that we're seeing in globally with a few people in control of so much. And it really irked me to see this. So basically what I did was put together some evidence which was absolutely clear in my mind and quite damning and presented it to the CFTC, which is, of course, the regulator for commodities. And we assumed, of course, that they'd be very interested in this whole story and that they would be very keen to act on it. Little did I know that we were opening up a sort of a hornet's nest. Normally, I know that good old Ted Butler for many, many years, and I must say that it was Ted that first alerted me to the fact that there was silver manipulation. And so I will credit, everyone should credit Ted for his hard work over the many years. But essentially what happened was I presented some evidence. The CFTC had never gone back to anybody. I mean, they don't call anyone. So I basically said, look, I've got inside information here. And they were all over me. I had to sign all the paperwork. And I think they were looking to see if I was involved in any way, which I wasn't on the inside of this thing. I just discovered what was going on and presented it to them. Sat with them for many months, in fact, over a year, showing them, walking them through, giving them slides, warning them of upcoming events, coming manipulations. A bit like saying, well, look, you know, there's going to be a bank robbery at a bank machine on this particular road at 3 p.m. tomorrow. Can you just be there? And of course, when you do that 85 times, and there's nobody ever there to do anything about it, you start to lose faith. Essentially, long story short, and I know that a lot of people have a very bad feeling about Bart Chilton, but he was the one commissioner that at least answered questions. And I know everybody seems to have doubts and say, well, he was just part of the story and trying to keep everybody, you know, befuddled by being the good guy of a bunch of bad guys. But I don't believe that for a minute. These commissioners have never responded to anybody ever before. And he, in his good name, did respond to every single email he ever got, no matter who it was from. Long story short, I got frustrated. They were doing nothing. The CFTC was doing nothing. I was sitting with the regulators. They weren't doing anything. At that time, there was a metals meeting being called on the 26th of March, 2008. I was invited by Bart Chilton to come and present some evidence to, they were going to have HSBC, JP Morgan, all the major banks, the bullion banks were all going to be there. I have to note that JP Morgan didn't turn up for some odd reason, especially it was a meeting about the metals markets and, one of the biggest players decides to not come, but HSBC did turn up. But anyway, 3 days before the meeting, I was suddenly uninvited. And there was nothing Chilton could do about it. I was live on the phone with him for the 6 hours of the entire meeting, though, and he was presenting my questions. But just before that, I got frustrated, and dear Adrian Douglas, who is no longer with us, unfortunately, I presented him he was director of GATA. I presented him the evidence I got and just dropped the bombshell on them and said, look, I'm not invited directly. I'm going to be having I'm going to be live on with Bart, but on the other hand, could you please, is there anything you can do to get this evidence in? Well, Bill Murphy, as we know, was invited to that meeting, and he did present that evidence, and it really created a bit of a bombshell, because at that point there, no one had ever discussed the fact that I think the bottom line of it is that the questions were asked directly through, say, Bart Chilton, asked HSBC, and this is all on record. That video is still up and running on the CFTC site. It's 6 hours long, and basically asked questions of HSBC, which I phrased to Bart. Is there or is there not 1 ounce of physical to back up every ounce of futures contracts? Well, no straight answers, but the bottom line is that it raised the issue that there was high leverage. And we had industry apologist Jeffrey Christian come on and say, well, yes, so what? It's 100-1. But that statement in itself, nobody had ever had that statement before. No one had ever seen that statement before. No one was talking about this kind of leverage that was going on. And I think that I know for my part, I was receiving telephone calls from clients and people that I'd never spoken to before saying, is this for real? Can this be for real? That this is fully accepted that this leverage is 100-1? I think we'll find that right after that, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that gold rose, what, $700 in the next few months after that, and silver rose significantly higher. I think people suddenly woke up to the fact, well, you didn't have to be a lover of gold and silver to realize there's a you could smell a trade here. There's something not quite in balance. So perhaps it's time to, if it's not in balance and it's been, and this is the kind of leverage involved, well, the sharks move in and start smelling blood in the water. So they come and squeeze it. If there's a big short position, you're going to squeeze it. And I think that's exactly what happened. And the, you know, obviously we all know what happened when it got to the highs. The May the 1st, 2011, when it reached almost $50 silver, how we all remember how on a bank holiday in the UK and Europe, bank holiday in all other parts of the world, China on holiday, somebody in the COMEX decides to wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning and dump massive amounts of silver into the marketplace. And of course, we all know what happened. That was a $6 move down in a matter of an hour or so, which is what, $30,000 per contract. You know, suddenly someone decides that this is the right time to get the best price. But it really says how difficult things have become for the banks, who over time had, and Chris Powell does marvelous work, you know, and also, of course, Bill, detailing and documenting the rational reasons for why these sort of leverages are built up and why interventions happen. And of course, now, you know, all the pointed fingers and said, you know, that's impossible, it's not plausible, you know, how can this kind of conspiracy be held down? How could no one have talked about it before? Well, of course, we now fast forward to today and everybody fully accepts, well, of course, there's manipulation in every market. So, you know, it's interesting to see how just in general, how, you know, how the people are viewing the market in different ways than they did just back in 2008, 2009, when none of this seemed it could possibly be happening. So now it's such interesting times, because what's happened is essentially we've ended up in a position where these banks, who were so highly leveraged, had accrued those positions over time. And I think Chris Powell's done a marvelous job of explaining how that happened. And there was the gold carry trade that was born by Robert Rubin. And, you know, when you've got 8-11% interest rates, you know, you lend gold into the marketplace, you flog that gold off, it disappears into a black hole. And you invest that money into some other high yielding assets, like bonds or whatever it might be. But over time, and the temptation to leverage, of course, and the fact that you're running a fractional reserve system, built up these massive amounts of leverage and underwater positions. And if, you know, if those pesky people that come and take physical in size wouldn't have turned up, none of this would have ever been a problem. Unfortunately, people woke up to the fact, and this has been a slow progression, but people have woken up to the fact that there's a mismatch. There's an imbalance in the market. There's not a true value here. So now we have we see divesting, and you've done some marvelous work in your interviews with many eminent people who've explained very well why we've got problems. You know, why it is that that people are, like the Chinese, are divesting their dollars like it was sand running through their fingers. They just want out of dollars, and they want to buy everything from land to art to gold to silver and mines, you name it. They're divesting themselves of their dollars. But, you know, we're talking about gold here, so gold has been one of the things that they've been accruing in very large size, you know, for all the reasons that many of your guests have discussed.
Well, I concur with you. I think that it's fascinating to see the sea change in understanding with regard to manipulation. And I'd like to underscore this idea of 50-to-1, 100-to-1 leverage. Go back to, let's say, the 1920s. It required about 10-to-1 leverage to lead to the great bubble that we now refer to as that, you know, stock market peak of 1929 that led to the Great Depression and whatnot, or at least it was a vital component. So we fast forward and we hear Andrew McGuire say, oh, 10 to 1. No, no, 100 to 1. And you start to get an idea of what we're facing. It gives those, particularly at the top of the pyramid, I think, a remarkable lever for manipulation. And that's the next thing I'd like to move into, the silver market. And you've done such an eloquent job outlining the mechanism behind the scenes holding down the market. And you talk about tens of thousands of contracts sold short. If you know precisely when the market is going to crater, you have that inside knowledge, the potential profits are in the millions. Can you give us an idea of what you think is going on here, or at least happened in the silver market?
Well, absolutely. But as traders, we follow these footprints, and it's really easy to see who is selling in size and when they're timing sales, where liquid market conditions, when very much timed, when there's a trend line or a pivot that's so blatantly obvious. You know, we see these 2 a.m. in the morning, suddenly someone comes in and decides to unload a product. Well, you know, you have to remember, we have to remember that there are 6 primary bullion banks that hold gold accounts at the Bank of England. Now, that gives them, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, that gives them an inside track. And, you know, obviously the Bank of International Settlements has a very active trading desk. These 6 bullion banks interact with the Bank of International Settlements on a daily basis. Now, for example, last non-farm payrolls, okay, we wonder, who was it that front ran that? You know, who is it that repositioned themselves? Well, you know, if you're in the inside, you would know that number. Put it this way, the Fed knew that number days ahead. It certainly wasn't everyone suddenly uncovered it the 5 minutes before when they released it to the news services. And so, you know, you'd have the Bank of International Settlements placing orders and buying and sell orders, and of course the 6 primary bullion banks that have accounts there would of course be fully aware of that. And even if there was no direct, this is the exact number, they would know that somebody was positioning short or long. And of course that gives you an inside track. And you know, you don't know how far those boundaries extend, but certainly we've found out through many instances, really, since the LIBOR scandal, since these chat rooms that are up, since these various things, that it's quite common for insiders to share information and trade on it. So it's not conspiracy theory. This is what happens. So, you know, but I think what is it really interesting, because as much as we all fully acknowledge that there's manipulation in the markets and that there are a certain few insiders that control it, I think what is changing, I think to me, is, yeah, but where are the changes? We see these wash and rinse cycles, you know, in a synthetic market, which is primarily the COMEX, which is a non-delivery market. I mean, it amazes me that I say, give you a head shake to people when you actually think that a price is being set in a non-delivery market.
The Shanghai Index, this comparatively small market, nevertheless, it does deliver, and they are delivering a remarkable amount of bullion. And then shouldn't we trust that price?
Absolutely, because delivery, I don't know if any of your listeners have ever been in the COMEX vault, but delivery constitutes a forklift truck picking up some pallets and driving it across a blue center line in the warehouse to the other side. That's delivery. And to me, and obviously, I mean, there's some legitimate transactions, but essentially that's what it is. I mean, there's such a tiny percentage. I mean, the audacity of backing up a Brinks truck and asking for delivery. I mean, you know, that's just not done. It's not playing the game. But I think what's so interesting is, as you say, the fix, you know, for example, the fix, we see the fix coming, and then the new so-called transference fix. I mean, nothing's changed there. And I think what we forget is that this diluted fix price, which has been, bearing in mind, also encompasses about 500 to 600 tons of of gold traded in a day and cleared in a day, and some nearly 5,000 tons of silver cleared in a single day. It obviously dilutes the fact that when you have a physical fix occurring, that it's not all physical, that there is huge dilution in that, and that there's because there's a degree of gaming in that, and the reliance on the fact that these LBMA clearing banks, you know, settle amongst themselves, much like COMEX is shuffling stuff around the warehouses, very similar at the end of a day with the LBMA bullion banks are shuffling stuff around, and of course there's a small physical offtake. And that's the interesting thing, is because, you know, obviously 3 to 5 tons might come in from producers every day. That's legitimate organic sales. That obviously is part of the process, but that's diluted too. I think, you know, what really, really sort of gets me excited is the fact that, as you say, there are other fixes now, and there are fixes coming from physical markets, and the physical markets are no longer in the US or London. They are simply not there anymore. They have migrated. The LBMA have lost control of the physical market and is now firmly in Asia. I think, you know, what really excites me is that the competition that is now coming up against these LBMA bullion banks, who are still sitting with a residual underwater position that's been accrued over time, over many, many years, and suddenly this physical is evaporating out of their hands. And I think, you know, I don't know if you've heard about the very shortly to be announced, the allocated bullion exchange, which is a physical marketplace that enables every single person to access wholesale physical metal directly without going through any of the LBMA systems, and that totally it's going to a totally level and arbitrage the divergences between the paper centric markets and the very increasingly liquid physical markets. And this price is going to be determined by real physical transactions, you know, and that's going to be conducted full time, seamlessly, 23 hours a day. I mean, the leveling process there is already underway, because we've already, the founding company, for example, Bullion Capital, I'm part of a membership exchange where there's lots of us brokers who are just simply transacting outside of the LBMA system, and it's something they never envisaged, and this is a massive game changer. And, you know, so I can be one of my clients, or I can be trading for a client against, and on the other side of that trade there may be the Bank of China. There's no visibility anymore for the LBMA bullion banks to know who is buying or selling those physical contracts globally, and that the loss of visibility for them, it ruins the game for them. So next time somebody decides to come in at 2 a.m. With a sell order in the COMEX market, it sets a price, and that price is going to be pounced upon by somebody in the wholesale market, and that's not going to happen again. So bearing in mind, we have these changes coming. So I think it's very encouraging to see that these continuous manipulations that people are so skeptical will go on forever, I believe are going to end, and they're going to end in this 2015. Within this year, they will end.
That's going to be a remarkable change in transparency throughout the sector. I'd like to ask you about this backwardation situation. We've had James Turk on here, friend of the show, for a decade now, and he was one of the first in the industry to point out the significance of gold and silver backwardation, but particularly with the yellow metal. His primary point is that why would gold in the future be worth less? Why would we have this state, not of the natural contango, but in backwardation, and for such a lengthy period of time? You could argue that we haven't seen anything like it ever in the markets. And you've also tackled this tough issue. Tell us more, please.
Yeah, and James is of course a real expert in what he talks about, and I must say I do like James. When I look at backwardation, I'm looking at, and I think a lot of people you know, a lot of people look at it differently. And I think the way you have to look at it is not futures to futures. So you're looking out, say, the curve from June to next December, and that you can look out and on that curve. However, that is a dilutive curve. That is, again, based upon a futures market that has a non-delivery market. So what I like to look at is the real spot price, i.e. the cash price of gold. So every morning I look at the cash price of gold, and that is where I can take a bar for, and I can literally sell it for, because everyone follows the real spot price, which is XAU USD. It's as simple as that. That means I'm either long against the dollar on the foreign exchange market, or I'm short against the dollar in the foreign exchange market. But that relates to the physical price. So that is what I can transact my physical for. So here's the question: why would I, when there has been permanent $1 and up to $1.50 per ounce backwardations, i.e., I can sell my spot for a buck to $1.50 higher, then I can buy a front month futures contract which is going to expire in just 2 or 3 weeks, and I could do that in any size I want, hundreds of thousands of ounces. Why wouldn't I do that? Why is nobody doing that? Why is nobody arbitraging that? It's simply because the physical isn't there to do it with, and nobody trusts to unload their physical. I'm not going to unload my physical on a trade and just simply say, oh, I'll get it back in 2 or 3 weeks from now. Well, maybe I won't. Really, do I want to be selling my physical at this point? This is the interesting thing. You then look at the co-basis, which is obviously, when you look at the backwardations, we also look at the co-basis. And that's also evidencing tight supply. I mean, we're talking about as bad as it's ever been at any price level. And that telegraphed, and I already 2 weeks ago said that's telegraphing a $1,300 price right now. And that factors in, even factoring in fractional reserve dilutive inputs. But, you know, obviously the real price, well, I mean, that's anybody's guess, Chris. I mean, because, you know, obviously that if you take the dilutive aspect out, I couldn't, if you asked me what the price should be, I wouldn't know other than it's significantly higher. But even based upon the inputs that are dilutive, $1,300 was $100 higher than we were last week was already obvious. So, you know, I think, you know, we have to look at these things. And it amazes people don't look at the technical side of it, the pure mathematics of it.
We did have Rob Kirby on recently, and he's done considerable work in the area, in particular in Asia. Now, according to his sources, that the actual price of large blocks of gold, now we're not talking the typical day trader here, watching the blips on the screen and in the office, significant size can be as much as $500 to $600 over our current spot in order to obtain delivery. Does that answer the question somewhat?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And what we do know is that size is almost impossible to come by. You're not going to get size at current spot prices. And that's absolutely correct. So I think what we're seeing is a market that is so divergent. The price of gold is so divergent from the reality that there can only be we're heading for a cash settlement. I totally believe there is only one solution to this. This is a hugely underwater situation. It's developed. It wasn't anticipated that the physical market would migrate away from the control of the LBMA. They're sitting on massive derivatives in the billions, and those derivatives is the only reason that we see price suppression is because there's massive derivatives exposure. And as I said to the CFTC all those years ago, you don't do anything. One of these days, the physical market is going to run over these two big to fail banks, and it's going to force a settlement.
Well, in particular, when you don't have the deliverable physical gold. I mean, as you've pointed out, Western central banks simply have run out. The central bankers don't have the stockpile to suppress gold. It's getting thin in their vaults, according to your work.
As you say, there's no central bank. They're too busy eyeing each other with suspicion now. And the repatriating, everyone's looking to repatriate. As you say, there's no central banks now lending real physical into the marketplace. That, to me, has to result in one of these days we're going to have an overnight settlement. It just is the only way where it won't be considered a default. And bear in mind that these fractional reserve accounts are in unallocated form. Most people don't realize they don't have any right to the gold at all. And one of these on a Friday night, between a Friday night and a Monday, what they'll do is there'll just be a cash settlement, and that'll be the end of it. And what's another few billion on an electronic keystroke to settle everybody out, and everyone walks away except people who held their gold, or the pension fund who thought they diversified part of their portfolio into physical gold or gold, and suddenly wake up and find that they're on the sidelines with no exposure to it whatsoever.
Now, as we wrap up here today, I wonder if there are any other topics that you'd like to share with the listeners.
No, I think really, other than the fact that I'm so excited now that things are changing, finally that things are changing, and that the control that these bullion banks have had over the market is evaporating, and we will at the end of this year, I predict strongly by the end of this year that the markets will be turned on their head, changed radically, and bullion will trade at a real fair value.
Well, you know, we've seen some remarkable changes already. I mean, just look at how fast gold skyrocketed in terms of rubles. Just a few months, we can see events unfold, and it seems to happen at a much faster pace, you know, in this digital world that we live in now. So any other contact information you'd care to share today?
Right, yes. Well, I do offer a trading service under my name, which is Andrew McGuire, goldtrading.com. You know, obviously, I just track the markets intraday, and I let people view what trades I'm taking, when I'm taking them, and the rationale for it, intraday commentary. So that people find that quite helpful. I have a lot of institutions that follow me on that basis. But I think more interestingly, I'm now trading wholesale physical for some very large clients and some large funds now. And that's really what the focus, I think. I want to stay on the physical side of things, and I want to be on the right side of a very large move, change in the wholesale market. So I think we're finding so much interest now on the wholesale side of things. So that to me is the focus that I have at the moment.
Tell us a bit more about this exciting service. Your market moves in real time, or I presume in real time.
Well, literally, I mean, this is it. I mean, I log on probably 5 or 6 a.m. in the morning and literally do an analysis, check the backwardations, look for the levels and the probable, the highest probable entry levels and exit levels that I think are appropriate for the day. And literally, I track that through the entire day and literally, you know, just tell people I'm buying it here and I'm selling it here. And people choose to follow me or not, or just use it. I mean, you know, basically, to me, I look at it as an educational service, but I know that there I have a lot of people who are trading in the hundreds of contracts again, and there are people then I use that information and then try and gain a little alpha for people who simply have large core holdings of physical, who then vault that physical, and we trade around that position for them, that basically, so that they can, they want to have exposure, a bit like a hedge fund in itself, but I don't charge any of those fees. I don't charge any fees for trading on behalf of them other than the normal exchange fees that we have. And so really, I just basically, that's what I do. And I fill my day up, and it's a very exciting and a really exciting and enjoyable business.
It sounds like a great service, and I know our listeners will be quite interested. Andrew McGuire, we appreciate you taking time today, and I know our listeners will as well.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Here is your your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bob Hoy has advised institutional clients for 30 years. He's the editor-in-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you.
As we were discussing before the show, the nuances and subtle differences in trading style, and you like to keep your finger directly on the pulse of the market. Give people an idea of what a typical morning involves at Institutional Advisors.
Oh, well, you know, we're out here in the West Coast, and so our day begins when the market opens at 6:30. And I think our West Coast people in the investment business enjoy it. Those who like to quit at the market close, it makes for a pleasant day because you get the afternoon off. But I'm always fascinated by the markets. You have the quotes in front of you on the screen. I don't have a huge Bloomberg or anything like that. And you have the opinion being given by the talking heads, which is always input. So, and then by later on in the day, you've had enough of the talking heads, so you turn the sound off. And then later on in the day, when I'm working, I kind of like to have action on TV, so I'll watch Turner Classic Movies. And what we're watching these days in the financial markets is the most incredible experiment by policymakers in history. This has been on for a long time, but in the last decade, they've become very frenetic, desperate. And here, I guess the big one now is the twos. They've got this idea out of nowhere that there should be 2% increase each year in the CPI. Now, I think if you talk to a mainstream economist and ask them why, they wouldn't have an answer. It's just a bureaucratic gesture. It's built into the system, and they can't get out of it, and it's arrived, the number's out of thin air. But anyways, in 20 years' time, a 2% rate of inflation will take a whole whack out of fixed income, and it's actually state theft is what it is. And but you take a look at since the Fed opened its doors in January of 1914, I think the dollar is, the purchasing power of a dollar then, today is worth about 3.5 cents. And they call this policy making. And these guys have, again, it's straight intuition on the part of the policy-making set. They, first of all, they assume that there is such a thing as a national economy that's isolated from all other economies. You have to assume that, otherwise you can't experiment in it. But of course, it's absolutely nonsense, because the connection, there are two connections from country to country. One is the credit markets, the other is trade markets. So you can't, there's no such thing as an isolated economy, even the U.S. economy. So then the other absurdity is that they saw that credit expanded with the business expansion. Sure, people borrow money. But they then make the conclusion that expanding credit forces expanding business. But that's what people call a primitive syllogism.
it's the urge to conclude that because two things are occurring at the same time, there's a causal relationship. And
it's interesting you'd mention that, because that's actually referred to as an Aristotelian syllogism. It's based on two premises. It's dark outside and the street lights are on. From those premises, we conclude that it is nighttime.
This is what is behind aggressive central bank policymaking. They really believe that expansion of credit forces an expansion of business, but it's not the case. As a matter of fact, you look at, and even then, commentators today are saying that the stock market is debt-propelled, like it's the credit ease that's pushing stock prices. It's the other way around. Stock prices rising will eventually be margined. So there's leverage, and that's what's facilitating credit expansion. And the old idea that credit expansion pushes prices up has been seen not to work, because in the 1970s, it was credit expansion that drove CPI inflation, like you had the wholesale prices going up and consumer prices going up and wages going up.
I don't agree with that this time around, because I think the circumstances are different. In fact, I just put out an article yesterday that proposes just the opposite. For instance, this time around, the debt has been targeted specifically by the major lenders, and then that almost entirely rolled into treasury stock of these major corporations. And as they do that, they, of course, cause two major sea changes in the market. Firstly, they boost their own price by buying up their own shares. And secondly, they reduce the supply outstanding because the shares are essentially put in limbo. It's now treasury stock. Traditionally leads the stock market higher. And we've been seeing that to the tune of $4 to $5 trillion in the past 6 or 7 years. I would argue that it is at least 60 to 70% of the bull market we've seen since 2009.
Oh, I know that the treasurers have been doing stock buybacks, and they're borrowing money. It's absolutely absurd to do it. But listen to this one. In 1980-81, the view I had was when I started presenting to institutions was that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks would outperform commodities. Now, at that time, the whole of the world was convinced that Fed printing was driving up commodity prices. But the reason for that was not my imagination, was that because in the commodities soared to 1920, so the big action was in tangible assets. They crashed. Then the next big action was in financial assets. The Fed didn't. Like in 1980-81, Volcker is given credit for ending price inflation. Money supply did not contract from 1980-81 to 1982. It kept expanding. But commodities crashed, everybody was leveraged, and then the action swung over to financial assets. Now, that was not the first time. The first time it happened was in the early 1700s when you had a long and great inflation in tangible assets, blew out in 1711. And then what happened? Then you had an era of inflation in financial assets, and then it crashed. So this is simply my case, is that the public chooses what will be speculated in. The central bank, it's only got one tap. It's on all of the time. But you go from in the 70s, inflation in wages and consumer prices, and then you go beginning in the 80s, you then shift it over to inflation and financial assets. So, and it's been most disappointing to the hard asset people. Gold bugs are having a terrible time explaining how you've got this reckless central bank and you've got gold in a bear market, well, in a bottoming market. So the main thing is that there is nothing new in the financial markets, and the game of credit expansion is not clearly understood.
Bob, are you at your computer? I just sent to both of your email addresses a chart that I put out yesterday that I came across. It's the monetary base as composed by the St. Louis Fed, and It's, I think, one of the more impressive. I mean, this is not new news. We've all known the money base has been expanded dramatically over the last few years. But this chart, I think, is emblematic. It really illustrates. It's the adjusted monetary base from the St. Louis Fed, text on it and pointing out some of the more important changes. And if you go back to the recession, what we refer to as the Great Recession from around 2008-2009, anyone like yourself who follows the markets minute to minute, tick to tick, at least in the early part of the day, will remember that was the end of the world. If you remember 2007, 2008, and early 2009, I mean, the financial markets were dead. All the blue chip stocks went to zero. People don't want to admit this, but the financial markets froze up and died.
On a boom, typically the yield curve will flatten or steepen or eventually become inverted. Usually it runs for 12 to 18 months against the boom. And then when the curve reverses and starts to steepen, it then says that the credit contraction is going to start. Now that count, and we counted it from January 2007, would be that June would be the 16th month. And our target was that in June, the credit markets would reverse. They started to reverse in that May. Now, I was in London at a financial thing for institutions on, I think it was June the 8th, and I pointed out on the slideshow I had, it showed a terrible train wreck. And the advice was that the greatest train wreck in the history of credit has started, and it started on schedule. So this was based on financial history, the way the markets really work, not how they ought to work. So I rest very comfortably with the idea that the public...
Well, first of all, let me say hat tip for that presentation. But nevertheless, I'd like to stick on this topic because you're focusing in on what I wanted to be the crux of today's dialogue. You know, Fed officials more than doubled the money supply during 2008-2009. And this chart I sent to you, I think, really illustrates this. And it's up here for everyone to see on our web pages and, you know, public world to either, you know, throw tomatoes at if you like. That's fine. I'd like your comments on this because it really required more than a doubling. Folks are so used to these numbers, big numbers, that I think it almost glosses over. It's just over people's heads. They're tired of hearing it. But I'm talking about deflating the value of every dollar in existence by half, more than half, in just a matter of 3 or 4 months. That's what was required to keep the economic patient alive. And you might think, well, that was the end of it. Another doubling was required from 2009 to 2011, and then another doubling from 2012 to 2014. And this process you'd think would be over now, right? Because unemployment, national unemployment rate is down so low. 100 million Americans are unemployed, 93 million to be exact. But still, we're apparently in this great recovery, Bob. It's only required a 4 to 5 fold increase in the money supply depending on where you look back to. The chart I just sent to you indicates it's in a consolidation and ready to break out to another high, which would require another 50 to 100% increase in the money supply just to maintain economic conditions as they are now. Tell me how this is not Zimbabwe or Weimar. I'm all ears.
In Germany in the 1920s had no credit markets. So they were able to do the currency inflation, just printing it, and we've all seen pictures of the wheelbarrow. Same with Zimbabwe, but it's entirely different when you're in one of the bigger economies and through these periods, the senior economy, where you have a huge credit market and they cannot do a Weimar inflation. It won't happen. Now, also on your chart of the expansion of the monetary base, note that it didn't really begin to expand until the crisis was over and bond prices and commodity prices and stock prices started going up. So my thesis is that the Fed needs speculators to bid assets up and borrow the money. It's not the idea that Fed expansion pushes prices up is just doesn't work in history. So what I look at this chart here, if you didn't have the greatest bubble in bonds in history, the monetary base wouldn't have expanded. So what you have now, I believe what will happen is that now it was our January 20 piece on the long-dated U.S. Treasuries, the speculation there, and we called it ending action, and noted that we were bullish on the bonds since 1981, and that this was the end of the great bull market in bonds. And then it also, in that paper we did in late January, said that the top in the U.S. Treasury market, which was late January, would be followed by the end of speculation in European bonds. And then since April 20th, the rise in the German 10-year note has been huge. And yet the Bundesbank or the European Central Bank has not stopped buying. Financial history has been driven by market forces, not policymakers. So here's what I think is going to happen. Bonds trashed, stocks trashed, further weakness in commodities, and then the central bankers will be cut off at the knees. They will not be able to be as aggressive as they have been. And it's also, you mentioned how forceful the central bankers have been with the 2008 crash. It's not widely published, but in the 1929 crash, the Fed eased hugely. The New York Fed, which is the big chapter then and it still is, it opened the discount window and bought bonds out of the market and exceeded its authority by a factor of six times. The Federal Reserve at that time was fully aware of Bagehot's dictum, which dates back to 1873, that in the signs of trouble, the central bank eases. Well, they did, and you still had a crash. It's just like in 2007, the central bank didn't tighten. They kept the pedal to the metal, and the whole thing still crashed. Okay. And then the expansion in the monetary base didn't happen until the markets allowed it to happen by having a speculative run in stocks and bonds. And since 2011, now there's another date, a model we call the momentum price forecaster, peak momentum forecaster, it called for a huge top in commodities, basic commodities plus gold and silver in 2011. And we called it a cyclical top, and there would be a cyclical bear market. Well, there's been a cyclical bear market in base metals and precious metals since. By the way, this year we expected a rotation out of Christmas whereby these depressed commodities would rally out to about May. So, Chris, I'm going to stay with my thesis that the markets allow the central bankers to become reckless. And when the market, and then you've got, on the bonds, you had extreme technical excesses. And it's going the other way. And this will be one of the most severe credit contractions in history. This is going to make 2008 look like just a blip.
I kind of respectfully disagree on at least one or two key points here. And what I've done, I've sent you another chart. And for our listeners, all you have to do is click the chart at the Nuggets webpage. And when you press your button, your mouse button over that, it will take you to the Fed's St. Louis adjusted monetary base. Bob, that's what I've just sent to you while you were speaking. Just quickly dropped it in an email, sent it over to you. Now, if you look at this chart, you'll notice from 1985, the Fed's monetary base all the way till about 1995, it took a 10-year period for the monetary base to double. Let's go from 1995 all the way to, okay, just at the beginning of 2009. So there it took, 95, almost 15 years, 14 years for the monetary base to double again. My hypothesis is this. Instead of 10 or 14 years, the Fed doubled the monetary base, Bob, in the matter of roughly 1 or 2 months. Then again, they did this, they did the same thing in, I'm looking at the chart here again, around 2012 to 2013, and then they did it again in 2013, 2014. Actually, that time they did more than doubled the monetary base. And it is my argument that you are right, that from all those previous periods you talked about, even going back to 1929, which would be your domain more than mine, I would agree with you. However, everything changed. When we were discussing earlier that 2007 through 2009, the financial markets ended. My argument is it really was the end of the world, meaning, and it never stopped. If the Fed has had to increase the monetary base almost fivefold, Bob, in essence, doubling it almost every year since 2009, to make us tread water. We're not in any massive economic expansion here. I think few people would really agree with that other than a mainline economist. If it has required that level, and if you look at the chart, you can see we are on the verge, on the cusp of parabolic money growth. I'd like to know how that does not end in hyperinflation.
Now, in the conventional description of inflation, it is soaring prices, isn't it? Here's what, if you want to navigate through financial history, the old classical definition of inflation works, and that is an inordinate expansion of credit. It is not an inordinate expansion of prices, but that inordinate expansion of credit will be against one or two things. It'll be against tangible assets, as to 1920, and then it will be against financial assets as to 1929. Now, in our own world here, the speculation in CPI and wages peaked in 1980 with a CPI of 14%. And even with this reckless expansion of monetary base since 2010, you're not getting any CPI inflation because you have inflation in financial assets. And this gets back to my point, is that the public chooses what it's going to speculate in. Into 1920, they chose to speculate in hard assets. And then the crash in 1921 had nothing to do with policy. But they sent, the Fed got very concerned about that crash. You look at a chart of the commodities. It's the biggest straight up and the biggest straight down in you know, one of them. So anyways, the Fed spent the 1920s easing money, being concerned to keeping prices from falling, consumer producer price or consumer prices. And they were looking over the shoulder at the stock markets because they didn't understand the stock market. So all of the extra lolly went into stock speculation, and the Fed did not tighten in 1929. That's a myth. That in the early 30s, those in the know knew that the crash and the depression was caused by the boom. But it wasn't until the 1960s when you had macroeconomics come along, and in order to employ their theories, they had to have a perfectly functioning agency such as the Fed. So that's when they began to say that the Fed made an error in 1929 and was tight.
From what I've read in history, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've read, I think it was Chairman Martin at the time, the Fed had quite an expansionary policy. In fact, in the 1920s, that's when they began, for the first time, their open market operations, which they've continued to do for nearly 100 years. And you might recall, they refused to raise interest rates, which kind of fueled the flames of the stock market boom all the more. They wouldn't allow rates to rise to a more natural level, and of course that increases speculation as we're seeing today.
They were very easy money policy through the mid-1920s, and it brewed up into a fantastic bubble, just like 1873. Or anyway, you know, they're all the same, these bubbles. You could take a chart of South Sea Company in 1720, and you can overlay it on a chart of Radio Corp of America, RCA, in 1929. You can overlay it on a chart of Cisco, say, in 2000. And you can overlay it on a chart now of IBB, which is the biotechs. So they're all the same, but the instruction is, in one era, Fed reckless or central bank recklessness will be part of a rise in tangible assets, commodities. And then in the next era, after they crash, the next era, it is in financial assets. So I suggest to you now that what has been going on in the bond market is the equivalent of the Weimar inflation of the 1920s. You have had hyperinflation in bond prices, okay? Now, what happens when you get price of any asset bid to the moon? Everybody's in. It's the trade of the day. It's crowded. And then
let me answer that, because back in 2000, the dot-com zenith, that money, which everyone thought would disappear, rolled into the real estate market, and we had nearly a 5 to 6 year bubble in real estate.
In a classic bubble such as 1929 or 1720, it's stock prices, and it is also some speculation in commodities, they're firm. That's why 2000 wasn't a 1929 type of bubble. So then you have a bid for real estate because everybody's making so much money in the stock market that they upscale in houses. It's all happened. So at any rate, the thing that I'd like to get across is that the Fed can only expand credit. The public chooses what it's going to speculate in. And you have had the equivalent of a Weimar inflation in the bond markets, and that burned up. It's starting to collapse now. So we will look, perhaps this time next year, at the monetary base, and I would suggest that it'll be way lower because of deflation and huge speculation in bond prices. And well, that's it. So here's what we're looking for now, is that this setback to European bond market has been horrendous. I mean, this when you get the yield from on the 10-year note in Germany go from less than 0.1% to 0.65%, that's a price drop. The shorts have made huge money on that, and they will gang up and they'll keep hitting each of these bond issues. So we've had hyperinflation since coming out of the 2009 contraction, and the hyperinflation has been in stocks and bonds. It has not been in gold. It's not been in copper, but it's been in the game that the public choose to play. Now, here's the other thing, Chris, is that while most think that the Federal Reserve is responsible in this speculation, it isn't. And then most think that it has all the power in the world. It doesn't, because is that once you're at the top, the power flows to the margin clerk. Now, of late, the job description of a central banker is to get the stock accounts and bond accounts offside, everybody leveraged. But, of course, the basic job description of a margin clerk is the opposite. His job is to get the accounts in line. And even the South Sea Bubble of 1720, it was a government-inspired bubble. They had the key stock, the South Sea Company, and they had the Bank of England, and it was all a go because it was funding the state. And they did everything they could to keep that bubble going. But in June of 1720, it ran out of energy, and it spent the summer turning around, and it crashed in the fall. And this is also our target on the stock market here. Peak now, churn through the summer. This is on the hot items like IBB, and then failure in the fall. So we'll see, and perhaps in the fall we can review just how the margin clerks can do it to the central bankers. I love it when it happens because it shows, as in 2008, that the greatest easing in the world could not prevent that stock market from concluding a panic selling.
Bob, I think that we agree on so many issues here. What I find fascinating is we've come to remarkably similar conclusions on totally different tacks. And I would also, you know, take issue with that last statement. If you look at the two charts I've sent over to you, and listeners can do the same, you'll see that it required, I don't think this is really my opinion. I mean, I think it's prima facie evidence on the chart. It required at least a doubling of the money supply to save all financial markets from complete annihilation. I would say we were within days to weeks away from all markets closing and going to zero. And I admit I'm probably alone on this. I don't know. I'd like to hear from listeners if you agree or whether you don't. I believe this chart shows the markets still are at zero, meaning that without government entirely, in other words, what I'm saying is the entire financial markets, and I know this is in stark contrast with your opinion and your work, Bob, but I'm of the belief that it is entirely the Federal Reserve, not 99%, 100% responsible for the fact that the financial markets are operating today. Were they to pull the plug even, let's say marginally, 15 to 20%, I think all markets would shut down that day. In other words, I would say that the chairman of the Federal Reserve controls the entire world. Were they to change this policy according to these charts, and again, this is just, I think, proven by the parabolic nature of this chart. And this is where we agree. I believe we are in the midst of a silent hyperinflation, and there is no way to go but up here with the monetary policy. If that ever were to change, I can tell you right now, I would get out of the Western world immediately, because I think everything will shut down. But I mean, all you have to do is see that it required 100 years to pump as much money into the system as we have in just a matter of a few years here. That is, to me, what I'd say 1920, 1921 in the Weimar. It's just a matter of time before John Williams at Shadowstats, I think, is proven correct. We will have a hyperinflationary a boom and then collapse. And we're in the middle of it right here.
Yeah, I would just say that you're giving too much credit to the Fed for ending the collapse in 2009. It was a natural one. Deserves a serious criticism is that in December 2007, just as the stock market was rolling over, Greg Mankiw, a Harvard macroeconomist, come out and said nothing could go wrong because the Fed had a dream team of economists. Now then you go into the worst financial collapse since the 1930s, and once it stabilized and started to recover in 2009, then the Fed was going around saying that if it hadn't have been for us, the panic would have lasted forever. Now consider this. In 2007, the establishment said nothing could go wrong. In 2009, the Fed said, without us, the wrong would last forever. I mean, this is so absurd. So then you want to look back on all of the great booms in history and the great crashes. They've all crashed in the fall. And they've all ended on their own. The notion that the Fed stopped the contraction in 2009 is completely unfounded.
I take issue at that point because from my perspective, quantitative easing worked very well for the Weimar Republic for a couple of years too, and everything seemed to be back on track. But once they fire up the printing presses in this fashion, history supports the notion that there's only one way that you can go. You have to continue stoking those flames because as soon as they're extinguished, the entire system implodes. And we have really, in my opinion, been living on life support since 2009. You know, this is what makes a market.
What this is the first bull market and the first economic expansion out of a classic crash. So it's sort of like 1937. And then we're about to, I think we're, the financial markets by September, we will know, probably really know that they're heading south. That would be both stocks and bonds, in which case the ability of the Fed to stimulate, expand, or whatnot, this will be the end of interventionist central banking.
Bob, it's just the beginning. Look at the chart. There's nowhere to go but up. We're at the top of the range. If this were a stock, you'd want to be buying right here. It's going to the moon from here. You're going to see $6.5 trillion on the Fed's balance sheet.
The margin clerks will have taken over and will have overwhelmed central bankers once again. There has been, since early 1700s, there has been, this is now the sixth example of financial asset inflation, and all five previous ones collapsed and led to a long contraction.
Okay, but point out one time in history where the monetary base, the QE operations were this intense and you didn't have hyperinflation. I can't find one.
Yeah, you're right, Chris, but I keep telling you that the hyperinflation is in the bond market. Bond market fails, the monetary base is going to collapse. Hey, let's talk about it in December.
All right, it'll be interesting. I'll give you a chance to tell folks a little bit more about your services.
We cover commodities, we cover currencies, equity markets, and fixed income. So we cover the whole thing. And I think we probably have the greatest recovery of history of any service that's providing opinion and suggestions on this market. Institutionaladvisors.com, or if you just Google my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, it gets you into all our systems. You can get on for, we run about 5 or 6 weeks on a free subscription, and then you either want to get on board or whatnot. So anyways, it's always good to talk, Chris.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for being patient with me and giving us lively debate here today.
Anytime.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Right, more GoldSeek.com radio. It's time for listeners Q&A. Opening up the phone line.
Hey, Chris. Thanks. This is former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. I wanted to address Harry Dent's points of view. While I agree with him that deflation certainly seems to be on the horizon and is here given the world's demographic trends, the one point that he doesn't reconcile and which completely doesn't make sense to me is that given the fact that cash is king in a deflationary environment, then why would not gold bullion be the equivalent? I mean, after all, he's saying that the dollar, which is essentially backed by debt and is backed by nothing, is going to be worth more than something that has 5,000 years of precedent. And again, I think he keeps saying that gold is a commodity, but it's not a commodity, it's money. So in that scenario, it would appear that gold would be king in a deflationary environment. Thanks again for what you're doing, and I always try to point friends and colleagues your way and keep up the good work.
Dr. Bernanke, hope you're enjoying your tenure at Princeton. You know, all kidding aside, the discussions with Harry S. Dent Jr. always seem to bring more responses than any other guest. I think he makes it very clear that gold is sound money. He believes in that, but he's convinced that during a time of deflation, which he thinks is upon us now, or at least headed this way, paper assets, in particular cash, will outperform safe haven alternatives. Now, I think he does deserve considerable kudos for being one of the few guests to correctly anticipate the dollar rally. From his perspective, it's simply prima facie evidence of deflation. And I don't share this opinion. I think that we are witnessing in the currency market flight away from euros ahead of an imminent Greek default. I think that the U.S. dollar is simply the least sick currency in the ward, and deflationists are confusing deflation with disinflation, which does not represent a decrease in the money supply, but it is a decrease in the rate of inflation. Now, I've used this analogy in the past to illustrate the subtle nuances between deflation and disinflation. I think a simple mind experiment or visualization will work. You might imagine a car traveling along a flat desert road. Up ahead is a steep mountain pass. If the driver keeps the pedal in the same position, obviously the car will ascend the mountain road, but at a much slower pace and maybe even come to a crawl. This represents disinflation, just as the car slows but keeps moving forward. Inflation has slowed, but it keeps growing. It all that's changed is the growth rate, or the rate of change. Conversely, if deflation were truly present, it would be similar to the car stopping on the mountain and then reversing course. In other words, just going back in reverse, back down the hill from where it came. This is not yet evident, I think, in the money supply figures and the inflation figures. But I wanted to back this up, so I printed out a chart and published it online. And you can find this in your Alpha Stocks newsletter account, or go to the Nuggets webpage, and it's from the Fed St. Louis branch. And you can see from the chart the money growth at the Fed was stable until the last recession. But around 2008, the figure went gangbusters. It has shot up nearly vertically since then. And the entire reason, I think, for the stock market rally is all that liquidity that's been poured into the system. It's simply been reinvested by the banks that were issued it, and then the corporations that it was lent to, they used those shares, as Louis Navalier has pointed out, to purchase back their own shares, their own capital stock, or treasury stock, which sends stocks much higher and reduces the number of shares outstanding. This amounts, I think, to a two-staged rocket. First, the massive share purchases, followed by reduced supply of shares, which sends stocks barreling in the exosphere. You can also see on the chart, the so-called economic miracle or recovery required a four-fold increase in the money supply. And that's a low-ball estimate. Actually, it's closer to five times what it was in 2008. Put simply, the Fed has diluted every dollar in existence by about five-fold. So then, why don't we see a five-fold increase in the cost of goods and services and housing, or even gas prices? The answer, I think, is surprisingly simple. Collusion among the corporations with the major lenders and the Fed. As long as the bailout funds and related liquidity, all $4 trillion, are held primarily in U.S. paper assets, such as stocks and bonds, then the inflation genie is contained. Nevertheless, with the threat of a rate hike nearly certain by September, December of this year, the market bubble could start to crater. And even with trillions of dollars of support. And once that happens, expect a Mount St. Helens-sized capital flow away from paper money and into the precious metals. You know, if I were asked to present my case for hyperinflation before Congress and I was allowed only two charts during the dialogue, this would be one of them. You'll also note that after the year-long consolidation, money printing is now back at the top of the range and poised to break out to new levels. If we use our consolidation theory from Edwards and McGee, you can see that the prediction takes us to about $6.5 trillion in Fed debt. That's about a 50% increase or more from the current levels over the next 2 years. And believe me, it can go much higher than that much more quickly, if conditions warranted. So why are house prices stabilizing? Why are share prices making a dot-com-like revival? Why are big institutions shunning safe haven assets? Who needs a safe haven when every investor has a safety net above the high wire? The Fed. That's right. The Fed has given the market, once again, a giant put worth of protection. So until this chart changes, I expect more of the same for at least another year or two. Of course, when this ends, well, it looks from the size of this chart that it would be the end for good. It may sound like an exaggeration, and it may be wrong, but it certainly looks like an end of the global financial system. The further out they extend that day of reckoning, I think the worse for the middle and working classes.
Hi, Chris. John here, formerly of Downers Grove, Illinois, now living in sunny Southern California. Wanted to call about Martin Armstrong. I just got to watch his documentary about him called The Forecaster. It was released today on Vimeo. I highly suggest that everybody watch this. I feel a little chagrined at having criticized Armstrong so strongly in the past. If most of this stuff in the documentary is true, which I'm sure it is, I figured that since he was in the joint that he had done something wrong. But of course, one always is thrown off by the government. I mean, these guys were absolute psychopaths going after this Martin Armstrong. If his computer models are as accurate as they have been in the past, all I can say is batten down the hatches, folks. There's a big storm coming. So I encourage you, I'm sure you've probably already seen it, and all the listeners to go over to Vimeo and join up or buy the video or whatever. Watch that video, The Forecaster, Martin Armstrong. Powerful stuff. But anyway, that's it. Keep up the good work. Really appreciate the show. Bye-bye.
Okay, next up, it's longtime listener and prolific caller, John from San Diego. He watched the Forecaster documentary, which stars one of my recent guest, Martin Armstrong. You know, John, I think you left us hanging there. You didn't provide any details. I haven't seen the documentary yet, but from what I've seen, it appears to involve some of the disturbing aspects of his incarceration. Around the turn of the century or so, he was a money manager who advised quite a lot of clients, and he was accused of rigging the markets by top officials. In reality, as pointed out, it's just absurd to think that one individual wields so much power. There really aren't many modern-day Livermores that we know of, other than maybe folks with deep pockets like Soros, Warren Buffett. But it appears that they were indeed trumped-up charges. At any rate, he certainly picked up the pieces of his life and seems to be doing quite well. He's well-respected around the world, and financial circles, for that matter, sought out by royalty and has even met with the British royal family. So, you know, hat tip to him, and thanks for the call. Closing down the phone line and reaching into our digital mailbag for listeners' email questions. Vidya's up, and he says in the Harry S. Dent interview, we mentioned stock and real estate. They tend to go up together. He says he's completely out of stocks, and he wants to know if stocks are going to go higher. He's 50% in precious metals. He's also concerned about hyperinflation and how gold and silver will do. Hi there, Vidya. You know, I hope that you'll consider subscribing to my Alpha Stocks newsletter. I cover all these issues each week. Stocks, I think, are overvalued, but you know the trend is higher. Homes, I think, are better valued, but the trend is also higher. Precious metals are undervalued, but the trend is lower. I like to buy assets when the trend is higher. So here is one strategy. You can build a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, real estate, slowly using dollar cost averaging, as long as the weekly and monthly trends are higher. And then when the precious metals start to perk up and show signs of an upward trend, start adding to that portfolio, as well as diversifying away from overvalued assets into gold, silver, and related equities. And then Patrick is up. He wants to subscribe. Well, hi, you're welcome to subscribe to my Alpha Stocks newsletter account. You can send over an email request to me at gsarthughes.net or just log on, and not shouldn't be too hard to find online. Vidya also is concerned about potential social unrest as economic conditions unwind. Well, you know, Vidya, I am concerned, and many other pundits are as well. I mean, imagine where would we be if 150 million people, half of Americans, stopped receiving monthly paychecks from the government? That's what's currently going on right now. 50 million families, roughly, require food stamps and food stamp-related debit cards. For the first time in global history, 99% of money is in digital form, if not more. What will happen when a currency panic ensues? I think the economic reset will be catastrophic, and no one will likely escape unscathed. Next, Warren says he appreciates the show. He views it as a great resource, and he's been following it for about 5 years now, and he looks forward to each new show and interview. He wants to know about an interview with Harry S. Dent back in 2011, but he just can't seem to find those. Well, hi there, Warren, thanks for the kind words. Yes, our archives going back to that date have been permanently archived by management at Goldseek, and if you'd like that to be undone, please contact the fine folks that make this show possible, and please thank Peter, Chris, and Vanessa, and all the folks there for keeping the show on the air, going on 10 years in just a few months, if you could believe such a thing, a decade of this. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. And remember, we'd like for you to call in your questions and comments. You can do so 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no longer toll-free, unfortunately. You can check the cost in your local area, 1-206-6666-5370. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. We've all heard in the background the past several years and taken them for granted. Stories about the super rich buying ever-appreciating high-end real estate, both here in the United States and abroad, with money no object. This kind of hyperinflation on material assets for the super wealthy has been allowed to occur in plain view without much of a spotlight placed on it. I'm talking about the homes and apartments that sell for $20 million 1 year, then $40 million the next year, and more after that. Scarcity drives the price. Dollars chase the assets because there are not many of those specialized assets to be had. No one pays a lot of attention to these markets because they are so tiny and specialized, kind of like the gold market. And the markets don't have to be as exclusive as $20 million apartments. But clearly, a form of free market hyperinflation has been occurring that Wall Street dollars have been chasing. It just hasn't entered into the world of gold and silver as of yet. Coming full circle, there was a Market Watch article this week that discussed how it's getting crowded at the top of Manhattan's $20 million apartment market, suggesting there may be a glut in this comparatively tiny market that has been allowed to flourish. The boom in the upper echelons of residential real estate is touching a handful of cities around the world, including London, Singapore, and Dubai, where the global elite are pouring money into top-quality homes. But the global elite aren't always right, especially if they have been ignoring things like gold in favor of socially acceptable forms of assets like global real estate. And then you have to ask yourself, what happens to all that overpriced city real estate when situations like Baltimore go mainstream or go global? What happens to the values of all those high-end real estate investments then? Portability, durability, universal acceptance. By that time, gold may not seem like such a bad idea after all. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.